Data DevOps and Security with Sagar Lad.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be highly effective through its ClearMeasure Way methodology for effective software teams. A quick announcement, my architect forums are still going strong. Signups for the next session are up, and you can find that link in the show notes. If you lead a software team or oversee a software team and are looking to collaborate with peer architect leaders, then just go ahead and sign up, and it's a great monthly conversation that I facilitate. And for those of you who are looking for the Programming with Palermo video podcast, you can just search in any of the directories and you'll be able to find it, or on YouTube, of course. My guest today on the show is Sagar Lad. He's a technical solution architect with a leading multinational software company and has deep experience in implementing data and analytics solutions for large enterprises using cloud and artificial intelligence. He's an experienced Azure platform evangelist with a strong focus on driving cloud adoption for enterprise organizations using Microsoft cloud solutions and offerings with over 9 years of IT experience. He loves blogging and is an active blogger on Medium, LinkedIn, and C-Sharp Corner developer community. He was awarded the C-Sharp Corner MVP Award in September of 2021 for his contributions to that developer community. He's also the author of 3 books, Mastering Databricks Lakehouse Platform, also Azure Security for Critical Workloads, and Hands-On Azure Data Platform. Sagar, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeffrey, for inviting me to your podcast. And yeah, I'm doing good and really looking forward to have a discussion with you. Hope you are doing good as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Great to have you on the show. Anyone who's written a book, much less multiple books, has definitely gone deep into some important topics. And I'd like to ask you about those. But before we get into it, we'd love to ask our guests to kind of go back in time and remember, what are the important turning points in your career that even led you into technology and this part of the technology world?
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty interesting journey, basically. So I have started my IT career, I think, almost 9 years back when I was studying computer engineering. And then, I got a campus placement through my college. And then I joined the project of mainframe, basically. So since almost during the first 5 years of my career, I have been working into technologies like mainframe, WMQ, having an enterprise bus implementation, etc., where I was a part of a private banking domain. And then all of a sudden, with the digital era and the big data booming in, I started doing some certifications and training. So I got trained in big data and Spark. And that's how I developed my area of interest, and I really wanted to move into the modern technology. So after finishing my certification, I parallelly looked for an opportunity, and I got an opportunity here to work for one of the leading Dutch bank, which is a client of my current company, where they wanted to do the cloud migration. So they have a big enterprise landscape, which involves a lot of technologies, mix of different tools, different vendors. But they wanted to move towards cloud. The main reason is it is pay as per use, reduce mm-hmm. the cost, and also modernize their technology platform.
Yeah,
that's how I got an opportunity where from the beginning, like we were the first team to move from on-prem to the public cloud Azure, where all my learning has started since 29, and the journey has been quite long and interesting So that's where I learned about Azure. I did a lot of learning and also completed a lot of certification tracks in Azure as well. at the same time, whenever I learn, whenever I do some certification, I also try to implement those new tools and technologies in the current architecture or a landscape. So that's where we were able to modernize the whole data and analytics platform, as well as the initiatives for our client. And mm-hmm. they were really happy with all the cloud adoption, reducing the cost, as well as also using the modern technologies to, let's say, decrease the time to market, moving more in an agile manner with a DevOps way of working. The journey has been quite a long, but it is quite an interesting journey. And during the each phase, even now, every day, I have to learn a new concept, new things, and we have to implement it. So that's the beauty of working in cloud and digital technologies.
Yeah, there's lots there. You're never going to be bored. Never going to be bored. Indeed. So what turned you on to a love of data? Because that's been a huge part of your focus along the way.
Yes, exactly. So initially, as I said, I started growing myself into Hadoop and PySpark, but then with the digital era, and especially when we had a COVID era, the digital 4.0 revolution is going everywhere, where not only technical people, but everyone, every person is inputting data on a day-to-day basis. So if you want to increase your business, if you want to understand what are the pain points of your business, basically, you have to go everything by the data. So let's say, even if I take my personal example, if I want to improve myself as a person, I want to know what good habits I want to develop or where I'm spending my time throughout the day. You know, I started journaling. So that's how I capture the data. And based on the data, I try to analyze and then come up with the outcomes, how I can improve my business, etc. So, you know, as people say, in the digital era, data is the new oil. So that's how I started, understanding and develop my interest about data on what we can do with the data. And, you know, when we talk about enterprise, let's say the big banks, or a banking institute, they are generating a lot of amount of data. And currently, I'm residing in Europe. So in Europe, it is not easier to use all the data, right? So there are a lot of regulatory reporting as well. Like we have GDPR, where you cannot use personal identity data without someone's consent. So basically, you know, we can do a lot with data. That's where my interest has grown to work more towards data analytics, where you know, there are a lot of raw data available, but then how we can make this data reusable that can be used by the business user, understand the business and gain more business or bring the value out of the data.
Yeah. Yeah. That's important. Now, you have some work around the concept of data lakes versus other types of data. In your mind, there's so much information out there, but some of it has a lot of technical jargon. How do you simplify? How do you best describe this concept of a data lake versus just a relational database or a JSON database or a document database?
Yeah, that sounds to be a very interesting and a debatable question. You know, when we started with our cloud journey, there has been quite a debate among with my peers. So basically, I mean, if we go and look back 5 years before, then most of the enterprise organizations or a company, they were developing the data warehouse where they simply prepare the dump of data, make it available in the data warehouse. And then on the top of that, those teams are building the reports or analytics reports, which can be used to understand different KPIs as per the business needs. But then there are various limitations of this implementation. So first of all, it is just a dump of the data, which is a read-only data. So, you know, you will have a huge amount of data, maybe 10-year, 15-year or 50 years of data. But using the right data, like it used to take a lot of time to identify the relevant data and then prepare, understand the business or do the analytics on the top of it. Mm-hmm. But with the concept of data lake, we can easily simplify. So nowadays, there are not only two, but there are three different topologies. So we have data warehouse, we have data lake, and nowadays, people are also implementing data lake house. So the advantage and the way of building data lake is that we can store structured, unstructured, and semi-structured data in data lake. That too at a lower cost. So in data warehouse, you have to buy a license. Let's say, for example, if you want to build a data warehouse in SQL database, you have to purchase license on the fly, mm-hmm. which is quite costly. And also there is a limitation on the data to be stored. So each, with the growing amount of data, your cost will also increase. But now, a couple of years back with the cloud adoption, where data lakes and blob storage, which are being provided by different cloud providers like Azure, AWS, or GCP, they are quite cheap. So you can store huge amount of data and there is no limitation at all. You can store 100 of TB of data, 100 GBs of data, and N volume of data. So you have unlimited storage. Only thing is you just have to store the data, but then the problem still remains where you have a lot of amount of different type of data available, but then how you can stop people working in silos. So if you talk about any data engineering lifecycle or a project, you will have data engineers who prepare the data, get the data, do the ETL, and then make the data available for the end user. Now, once the data is ready, it is the business analyst. They will use this data, prepare some report for the end users. And there are also data scientists as a persona, which will prepare the machine learning model on the top of the data we have, and then they will come up with some intelligent recommendations. Mm-hmm. But these three, even though with the data lake implementation, these three personas were working in silos, and there is a lot of problem. So the tool that is being used by data engineer might not be compatible with the tools used by business analyst, and you have to do a lot of manual work in between. But then there comes the concept of data lake house. It combines the benefits of both data warehouse as well as data lake, and then it has quite some let's say advantages. So basically, if you want to store structured, semi-structured, or unstructured data, you can store it in data lake house. Additionally, if you want to have a transactional system like data warehouse or an RTBMS, that is also possible with the concept of data lake implementation in data lake house. And data lake house is mainly the open source concept, which is bring upon by Databricks. So Databricks is a tool where different personas like data engineers, data scientists, or a business analyst, they can work on the same tool. So there are no manual overheads in between. So this is what is currently trending in the technology industry for most of the data initiatives.
So data lake house is kind of a combination or a merge between data warehouse and data lake.
Yes.
And so there's so many software teams out there that might not have a dedicated DBA or someone who knows intimately these. And maybe they've dabbled in data warehouse and they've created some fact tables and some star schemas. They've read the Kimball data warehouse books, but they just kind of dip their toe in the water and do a little bit, or they throw some documents or some JSON files at blob storage, or maybe use the Azure services. For those very light users, what are some common scenarios where you say, okay, data lakehouse can be really valuable, and here's a few of just the easy getting started scenarios that probably a lot of teams could take advantage of? What comes to mind?
Yeah, sure. So we can talk about few scenarios. I will take one scenario for, I think, each persona, one for data engineer, one for business analyst, and one for data scientist. Now, let's first take an example of data engineers or DBAs, basically. So in the traditional workload, what they do is, they have to have a DBA permission. Then they log in and then they play around with the data and come up with some insights. But then there are a lot of limitations or a problem. So there can be one or two or multiple DBAs in a team. One person thinks in a different way. So he prepares a table, he prepares the column name maybe, and the column type in a different manner. Another person, he is also implementing the same thing, but then according to him, the naming conventions for the column can be different, the data type can be different. So basically, it is really, really hard when the people are working manually without any policy enforcement. Then the consistency will be a bigger problem. And for this, maybe there is a scenario where both the DBAs are working on the same table, but then those table will look completely different because the column names are different and the table names are different. So mm-hmm. There is a lot of gap, but then this gap can be easily, remediated by the data lakehouse implementation. So in the data lakehouse implementation, there is also a feature of Databricks SQL. So it provides a SQL kind of a user interface on the top of Databricks Lakehouse, which is an inbuilt feature of Databricks. So let's say once you prepare the Delta table and it is available in the DBFS, you can create Delta table on the top of it. And once you create the Delta table, you can directly go to Databricks SQL and then you can use those as a table, how we are using it in a traditional data warehouse. So now the advantage of using Databricks SQL is that it will provide you the same kind of layer how you are already have an experience with. So you can simply run the select query in like a normal SQL database and use the data. Now, in this Databricks SQL tables, the way we are creating the columns, table names, they are completely consistent because we do it via an automated code using the Spark Infert Schema. Apart from this, there are also various other benefits. So this Databricks SQL has multiple connectors available. So if you want to connect, let's say, a tool like Power BI or Tableau to Databricks SQL, you can easily, just with a click of a button, with a plugin, you can connect to Databricks SQL and use that data to prepare the report. Now, in case you want to send an alerts, you can also configure different type of alerts. Let's say if you want to receive an alert in Teams, or if you want to receive an alerts in Slack channel, you can just configure it. Whenever some failure occurs, you will receive an email automatically. So likewise, there are a lot of additional add-on features of using this Data Lake House platform, which provides a wrapper as a Databricks SQL on top of the data we have available in DBFS.
Okay, so the users can use Power BI or Tableau, but the developers have to set up the data and make it and get it to the point where Power BI can connect in.
Exactly. Okay. So the main advantage here is it is a single tool. It provides a unified platform where data engineer can work and prepare the data. And on the same tool, business analyst can use Power BI or a Tableau to prepare the report. Whereas in the other case, you have to purchase separate licenses and then you need to configure it separately. Maybe the data compatibility will not be same in different tools.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
I'm curious, when you're using Data Lakehouse, which is basically the Azure Databricks service, right? So the Data Lakehouse is kind of like the pattern, and then Azure Databricks is the service in Azure that you use for that pattern. So when you're using Azure Databricks, what has to be added to the DevOps environment? What goes in source control? What adds to the build of the software application, maybe owns that database? And what do any kind of automated tests look like when you're delivering that kind of solution?
Yeah, that sounds a pretty interesting question because this involves the whole development lifecycle, how you do the development with Databricks, and also it involves the deployment part. So how you can enable your continuous integration and continuous deployment with any tool like DevOps or a Terraform or any other tool. So let's talk first about the development or current development you are working with Databricks. So in Databricks, if you want to do the development, there are multiple ways. So you can, if you want to do the local development, then what you can do is you can set up a VS Code, which is a Visual Code from Microsoft. You can use it as a local environment. There you can configure Databricks CLI. So with Databricks CLI, you can directly replicate the environment of Databricks cluster in your local workspace. Yes. Via command line, and then you can do the development and testing. Now, once the development and the unit testing is done, our goal is to...
Well, we'll stop that. Unit testing. What does unit testing mean in the Databricks world?
Yeah, sure. So unit testing in a nutshell or in a very layman term, whatever component that you have built they individually, they should be able to perform the requirement that for which we have developed it. So I want to develop a function where I want to find the most ranked person in the world. Then if I pass something as an input, then it should be able to pass the correct, it should be able to provide the correct output. Let's say Amazon owner is the richest person in the world, then that output should come. So basically unit testing is that we are specifically testing the individual functionality of a code to meet our goal, basically.
In the relational database testing world, a test of the schema and queries would push a little bit of data into the database and then exercise a query or an ORM mapping or a stored procedure, and then do that query and make sure that the right thing got pulled back out. In the Databricks world, do you have to have the data kind of set up ahead of time, or does one of those tests push in some data right at the beginning of the test in order to pull it back out?
Yeah, so well, it depends on scenarios. So there are certain scenarios where you can pass dummy data as an input. And if you pass a dummy data as an input, and if it is providing certain output in a format, then that can be considered as a unit test. Now, if you want to combine the unit test with the functional test, in that case, what you should be able to do is, let's say once the code is ready and once we deploy it, we want to make sure that whatever data that we have received from the source, the same data should be available in the target database, which is in the form of delta table, and that can be used by query using Databricks SQL. So in that case, we have to get the data, ingest it into the delta table, and then what we'll do is, as a part of functional testing, we go to the DBFS, get the data from the delta table, and try to compare it with what data we have received from the source. If they both match, then the test is successful. If they do not match, then the test has failed.
Okay, so those tests sound like they take a good number of seconds to run, or do
yes.
they, is a normal test duration 30 seconds, faster than that, slower than that?
Yeah, so it doesn't take more time, to be very honest, because here we, when let's say in your target database, you will have thousands of records.
Mm-hmm.
But when we do the testing, we do not do the testing with all the records. So we take the sample of some data, maybe a few hundred of data.
Okay.
So, and then we do the testing. So it hardly takes few seconds. And then Databricks is also very much powerful from the processing point of view. So how we have configured our cluster, based on that, we can determine the processing time. But it is just in few seconds, even not a minute.
Now, you mentioned the Databricks command line interface. When we're running these tests, is it running completely locally, or does it have to round trip to Azure?
Yes. So when we perform this testing, we don't run this locally.
Okay.
So the complete processing power lies with the Databricks cluster. So when we set up a Databricks, there is a Databricks workspace. In the Databricks workspace, there is a separate component for compute. So which we
in
call
Azure.
It as a Databricks cluster in Azure, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And then when you set up a cluster under the underlying, there are multiple Azure virtual machines which are running in. But then we don't have to worry about the complexity. We just provide the configuration and set up a cluster. And in the background, Azure VMs will be triggered and they will be used for the processing
right.
Okay. And computation. Yeah.
How much do you expect just using Databricks to cost? Like, what's the lowest amount that you could even, I don't know, do a proof of concept for? How much would you be expected to see in your Azure bill?
Yeah. So ideally, if I answer your question, if you just want to do the POC or if you want to do the play around, you can do it freely. So there is a Databricks sandbox version. If you log in with your student account or if you log in with your personal account, you will have a limited capacity. So you can spin up a cluster with certain configuration. You can do all the testing or all your learnings in the sandbox environment, which is free of cost. Now, coming back to the actual cost, when we talk about the production workload, it depends on your cluster configuration. So in Databricks, we have different type of clusters. So we have single node cluster, we have job cluster, and we have high compute cluster. So if you want to, let's say if you are building an application where you are not dealing with huge amount of data, you can use single node cluster. If I have an Azure workload where I am using Data Factory as an orchestrator, So I trigger Databricks notebooks via Data Factory. Then in that case, you can use Job Cluster. So what it does is when you trigger your Databricks notebook, it will start the cluster. And once the Data Factory activity is completed, then it will also stop the cluster. So the amount of time the cluster is on, the cost will be charged.
Mm-hmm.
And then there will be a high compute cluster. So if you want to work with, let's say, machine learning workload where you are dealing with huge amount of data and you want to do a lot of compute with all the machine learning algorithms, then you can set up a cluster with GPUs that are costly. So while setting up a cluster, you have to choose what cluster you want to use, whether you want to choose a standalone or a single node or a high compute cluster. And then whatever amount of BBUs you utilize, there is a cost involved. So you can go to Azure Pricing Calculator, and based on the approximate amount of usage you want to do, you can calculate the approximate price basically. But it is calculated in the form of BBUs.
And what's the most expensive Databricks environment that you've seen on a monthly basis?
Yeah, so on a monthly basis, I was working with the group of machine learning developers. They were using GPUs of cluster where once they start the notebook, the notebooks is running over the night and also in the morning for mm-hmm. 1 day, 2 days.
Okay.
They were using GPU clusters and they are quite expensive.
Like so $1,000 a month, $10,000 a month?
Yes. So for a month, the cost is around
30,000 euros. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And were they surprised by that bill? And did they say, oh,
yes,
shoot.
Yes,
and what did they want it to be?
yeah, exactly. So what happened is when we started with the Databricks implementation, initially, we did not set up any Databricks policies. So every people in the team, they can set up n number of clusters and n number of GPUs. But then when we recognized that the cost is going very high, then we started implementing the Databricks policies. So the team can have maybe only one or two cluster, and on even that cluster can have a limited GPU capability. So we can limit on the cost. But at the same time, we are also able to do the work, process our workload or our models.
Okay. And what did that pull the bill down to?
Yeah, then we tried to bring it down around 4K euro per month.
Okay. And at that level, were you able to do everything that you needed to do?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So that helps, I think, the listeners that you can try it out for free and you can do very, very significant things for $4,000 a month if you have
Indeed.
Massive amounts of data.
Yep.
Okay, great. It's always good to have bounds. If you say, the cost can go up from there, we'll go up how high? We don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And, I have been working with cloud for it's almost 5 years now. It is pay as per use, but then if you don't proactively monitor it, then with these small activities, you can save quite some cost for your company.
That's right. Well, before we close, you wrote another book called Azure Security for Critical Workloads. And I know there's no way that you could just regurgitate the book because it's quite large. But are there a few points where you would say, hey, every software team that's putting some software in Azure, here's some things that they need to do where you see that those things are just being missed around the industry?
Yes, I think it is actually a very, this book has a lot of good content. It's mainly evolving around security. So if you are any kind of company from any domain, it can be banking, retail, or manufacturing. If you want to move your workload if you're running your workload on Azure, then security is must. So it can be a data security, it can be an infrastructure security, it can also be the threat modeling process that has to be there to understand what kind of security risks would be involved.
Mm-hmm.
So in the industry, what I see is most of the time people are not doing the proper configuration while setting up the Azure service. For example, we have a SQLDB, then your firewall is open, it's not configured well. So not only within a company, but then outside company also, someone can try to access the SQL database and data stored in it. So the data security configuration, platform infrastructure configuration, having a threat modeling process in place to try to brainstorm with the team and discuss what kind of potential threat can happen and how we can rectify it. So these 3 points are really a must that you can pick up from the book, and also while you are implementing your application or developing your workload on Azure.
So I know in Azure SQL, there is a checkbox that says allow connections from any Azure service. Is that what you're talking about specifically?
Yeah, so it's not only, yes, you are right. You are bang on. So likewise, there are so many configurations. So you can set up a VNet or a subnet. Mm-hmm. So basically your SQL DB should only be accessible within your company premise, right, and that too by a certain team or a certain people. So you can configure a firewall, you can configure a VNet, you can enable TLS encryption, you can enable data masking, you can set up a policy. So likewise, there are so many features that should be configured properly, which we can do it with a click of a button, but then people just spin up a service and then they don't try to, let's say, closely look at those configuration, and that's how the data breach happens, which is quite massive for any company. When the data breach happens, then it's all about company's reputation as well.
So out of the box, when I allow a database or Databricks to be accessible by other services in Azure, does that mean that anyone that spins up a VM or any code in any region around the world in Azure could reach and attempt to log in to my Databricks or my SQL database?
Yes. So basically, I can do a deep dive a little bit. So when we talk about security, there are 7 layers. So the thing is, if you do not configure it properly and if you keep it open, then somehow it's not that much easy, but let's say if somehow I have written a blog and I have posted my SQL database name, then someone can try to use this database name and they can connect from maybe Databricks or a VM. But you are storing very critical and sensitive data, because if you are talking about a banking domain, you have a lot of critical information and PII information as well. So that's where for industries like banking, it is a must to have all the security layers or configurations in place.
Yeah, that's a really important part, because even before public cloud, there was discussion of some breaches because database servers were accessible on the open internet. And basically this is the same. Okay, it's not the open internet, but Azure is sufficiently large where it's anybody could spin up a service and then they could attempt to log in, just like it was just wide open on the internet. So I think that's a very good point.
Exactly. If you don't configure it, then you are just making it public for everyone so they can access it anywhere, anytime. So that's the risk.
Yeah. Right. And I think it's important to stress that configuration does not make it open to just people who are in your Microsoft 365 or Azure AD. That is open to the entire Azure world, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So in other words, aside from development proofs of concept with no real data, don't use that setting.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Well, hey, there's always more than we could ever cover in an episode, but thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all about Databricks and some DevOps points there and these important points on security. So thank you so much, Sagar.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeffrey, for inviting me, and hope people will gain something out of this podcast. And I'm really looking forward to connect with you in future as well. Yeah.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Sagar Lad, everyone. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.